I'm here tonight to introduce our wonderful, wonderful speaker. Her name is Katie. She's been a friend of mine for a very long time, and she is just an absolutely amazing woman. And I've never heard her story before, and I'm just thrilled to know her and that she's in my life. And without any further ado, I give you Katie E.
Hey, I'm Katie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
And I tell you what, if I get through this without fainting or throwing up, that's definitely God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I'm not any good at public speaking. I get really nervous, so let's see if I can make it. All right. Well, I was born December 6, 1980, which means I will very soon be turning 26 years old. I was born in Boise, Idaho. And I was born to two lawyers. And the only reason why I think I spend any amount of time on talking about my childhood is because I think it was instrumental in my story, in how I got here and how I hit my bottom and, you know, how I recovered once I got here. My parents were hippies turned yuppies in the 80s. And you know, I had a feminist mother and I loved my parents very much. I admired them. I looked up to them. I wanted to be just like them. I valued the things that they valued. So I grew up with, hold on, with, you know, a strong opinion about my personal education and about, you know, being like, you know, woman and roaring and stuff. And so, you know, we lived in Boise, Idaho. I was a perfectly normal child in a perfectly normal home for 6 years. And when I was about 6 years old, my dad decided that he wanted to become a priest. So we moved to New York City and lived in a seminary for about 3 years where he got his degree. And this was my first real encounter with God and spirituality, I think. I had been going to church all my life, but hadn't really thought twice about it until I was living in an environment where everybody was studying religion all the time. And you know, I think that I was lucky in that I had the parents I did and the environment I did, because you would think, being the daughter of a priest, I would have issues, or at least most people seem to, that I would, you know, resent God or felt like I'd had it shoved down my throat, but I didn't. I was a very spiritual child, had a good relationship with my higher power. Which I guess goes to show you, you know, there's this part in the book where it talks about there were many people who considered themselves, you know, to have religion, and that you know, they thought that if religion were the answer, that would be enough, but it turned out not to be the truth. We lived there for 3 years, moved to Macon, Georgia, and I was, you know, about nine, still everything going along, completely normal. I think that, you know, ironically, when I started to find my spirituality, that's when a lot of my isms came out. I don't know if any of you, I'm sure some of you, have heard the term isms. You know, I had an alcoholic personality before I ever even drank. You know, and I never really knew what it was, but for as long as I can remember, I felt different. You know, I think even back in Boise, I felt, you know, like I must have been adopted, or there's something different about me. I've heard a lot of people talk about that in their stories. I don't think it's a prerequisite. I've heard people who say that they never felt different, but I did. And, you know, so when I was in Macon, moving into the South, having been a Yankee, and, you know, I felt that even stronger. And I started to look for a niche. You know, I had this feeling that if I had the right group of friends or something, maybe if I could just find whatever it was that I was looking for, that there was something out there I hadn't come across yet, that maybe I could feel at home in this world if I found it. You know, so I continued to look all through elementary school, never really found anything, and then seventh grade happened. And, you know, the hormonal teenage years, some of you may recall. I knew that, you know, this is feeding into high school, and I had a feeling going into the seventh grade that this is where it was going to happen. This is where I was going to find the group that I had been looking for. Instead, I found a boyfriend in the seventh grade, and the only reason why that is really relevant is that his mother ran the local Alateen group, which I had no business in being in. I just really thought this boy was cute, so I started going to Alateen. yeah, they were a lot more fun than the church group anyway. I got to go out on Wednesday and Sunday nights when otherwise I would have had to have been home, and they cursed and they smoked cigarettes, and I thought they were really cool. And so I spent the next couple years going to Alateen and learning all about alcoholism, and I learned all this stuff, and I think I accused my father of being an alcoholic or something. I can't remember who I blamed it on. I think they all saw through me, but they saw the isms. I remember the Alateen counselor saying to me that I had the isms and that I should be careful. So, my early years in middle school, I was spared of the experience of drinking and drugging, even though I had already figured out who the cool kids were, and they were the ones drinking and drugging, but I was spared it because I was, dating this boy. And then we broke up around the middle of my eighth grade year. And when we broke up, alcoholics were sensitive people, and I was definitely a very sensitive person. And I felt as if, the group, his mother running it, had turned against me, which in retrospect I really hadn't. But I wanted to rebel. So I remember my first drink happened. I went and spent the night at my best friend's house at the time, and we were going to go out, and we were going to sneak out of her house and go meet some boys, and that fell through. So we were sitting there, and I was perfectly content to spend the rest of my night just watching Beavis and Butthead. But she said that her dad had, this liquor cabinet that she thought she could get into, and I don't even remember what it was that she got. It had a bird in it, some kind of turkey or crow or something, I'm not sure, but it was disgusting. And she brought this stuff down, and I immediately began to drink just like an alcoholic. I don't know if I crossed the line right away. In the big book it talks about how we cross the line from being problem drinkers to alcoholics, the point of no return. And I don't know when it was, but I know that I immediately started drinking like an alcoholic. She would pour a shot and then give me a chaser, and I'd, chug the shot and skip the chaser, and I just kept doing that as fast as she could pour them. And I just remember she said, "Oh, I think I'm starting to feel it." And I was like, "Really? I don't feel anything." And she said, "You don't?" I was like, "Yeah, I'll walk a straight line." Because, I'd seen Cops. So I knew that you weren't feeling it unless you couldn't walk a straight line. And I stood up and fell right back down. And then that was it. I think she gave me an Arby's sandwich at some point and I passed out. I don't remember. A lot of people's stories, they drink at a party for the first time and they have the courage to ask out the girl or the boy or dance or get their first kiss for the first time. That wasn't my experience. I ate Arby's and watched Beavis and Butthead, but I had arrived, I had that feeling. This had completed me, and I knew that I wanted to do this again as soon as I could. And I think that after I've been sober for a while, I've listened to some stories, and I think I've heard some other people explain it in a way that I couldn't have. And Johnny H. talks about this. He says that, his whole life he felt like he was too good to be with the bad people, but not good enough to be with the good people. And that's kind of how I felt, And I think that for a long time, this not being able to be on eye level with anybody is what had made me feel completely isolated from the world. That feeling of being in a room full of people and just feeling on a different plane of existence than they were. And I didn't feel that night with my Arby's and turkey or crow or whatever it was. That was gone. And the next morning I walked home a few miles. I don't even know how long. I peed in somebody's front yard. I was still drunk. I remember walking through the house trying not to run into my parents. Thank God it was Sunday, so they weren't, they were kind of off trying to get ready for church and stuff. I didn't drink again until like a week or so later. At that point, I was really just drinking when I could, which wasn't that often, and I didn't, do a whole lot to make that happen, just weekends or whatever. Shortly thereafter, I don't remember how long it was, I smoked my first joint at a treatment center outside of the Alateen room right before going into Alateen. Charter Lake, I think it was. We were walking around the lake smoking. And after that, I was I knew that this is where I wanted to be. Another thing that it talks about in the literature in AA is how you'll find a fellowship of friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really felt like I had found that with drugs and alcohol. You know, that was my first experience with feeling that. Like, I felt like, you know, all of the people who I wanted to be like, and, you know, all the people who I wanted to hang out with, the people who were like me, were doing this, and we had this common bond that we were eighth grade losers and, you know, drinking and drugging all the time. And I dove into it head first. So that was, you know, coming up on the summer of my eighth grade year, we were going to go into high school. And by the end of the summer, I had hooked up. I was dating this other guy, some guy who was 17 and had an apartment. So by the time high school came around, I was already drinking pretty much every day. If, you know, if I had the chance, I, you know, would drink hot beer. Didn't really care. It was not at the point where I had to have it, though. If for some reason I couldn't have a drink that day, you know, I was a little disappointed, but I was all right, you know. But I remember when the first day of high school came around, I went the first day, and I think I went three more times that year. I just remember having this feeling like, damn, you know, the summer's over, and I just didn't want it. And I kept, you know, alcoholic, you know, justification. I thought, well, you know, if I miss the first week, maybe I can tell them I was out of town or something. And then after that, I missed the second week, and I was like, okay, well, they know, and so I have to wait until I come up with an excuse. And one thing led to another, and, you know, there was the parent-teacher conference day where my parents showed up, and they were like, we haven't met her. So that was a bad sign. And I remember that was the, my parents caught on, you know, they were very, you know, slick people, my parents. I was sneaking out every night, you know, I would sneak out every night and I would stay out until like four or so in the morning. Then I'd go home and go to sleep so that they could wake up and take me to school, and I'd have them drop me off a block down the street from school, and then the boyfriend would come and pick me up and we'd go pass out. And then, you know, people would come over and we'd drink. And so one of those nights they caught me sneaking out. And this was how the confrontation happened. This was, I think, my first encounter with the police, too. They called the police, you know, for unruly charges, truancy charges or whatever. I think they just wanted to scare me. And I convinced them not to press charges on me that time. But the pattern continued. My parents said that they realized that at this point in the semester I was going to fail anyway. So I might as well not go, and I was cool with that until the next semester. But then when the next semester came, I did the same thing. You know, this whole time my isms were still there. I was, you know, very angry, very defiant, and I was for the most part very depressed unless I was drunk. And I never really put that together. I never really saw any kind of cause or effect or even a correlation between the two. Maybe I was just, I'm sure I was in complete denial, but I was not kind to my family. And so this cycle continued of me sneaking out and them calling the police. And, you know, I continued to sneak out of the house. By the next year of high school, I was still in the ninth grade and, you know, was a little put off by the fact, but I had this plan. You know, we alcoholics were great at planning. You know, I knew that I could think my way out of this. If I just went to summer school here and did this and did that, then I could graduate on time. But, you know, my partying always seemed to get in the way. And at this point, I think I was getting to the point to where I was a little obsessed. I wanted to drink all the time. The few days that I went to school, I would drink there. I got a Ritalin prescription, which was lovely, for my ADD. And, you know, yeah. So I started, you know, partaking in that whenever I couldn't get a ride out of the house or whatever. So after the cycle continued of me, you know, continually sneaking out and getting caught, they started calling the police right away. So I remember I'd have to come home, and if the porch light was on, I was caught. And I would have to shower to get the smell of alcohol off of me. By this point, you know, I was drinking as much as I could. And, you know, like, I love when young people come in and they say, well, I never drank in the morning. You know, I always drank in the evening or in the afternoon, but I slept until 2. So, you know, the logic was faulty, but I didn't see that at the time. So anyway, you know, I'd have to shower and wait for the cops to come and try not to smell like liquor when they got there and play it straight. And eventually I was on probation. And I would sneak out anyway on probation. And there was, you know, this kind of cycle of, oh, God, am I going to have to go to YDC because I got caught violating probation, blah, blah, blah. Finally, my parents got sick of it, so they nailed my window shut. I don't know what took them so long. They got an alarm system on the house and wouldn't tell me the code. And they did storm windows and bracket. I mean, they were serious. They put paint. I didn't even know this until after I got sober. They put paint trays under my window so that when I jumped out of my window, I would get paint all over my feet and then track paint across the yard, and they could see where I'd gone. And I just, you know, I'd get drunk, and I'd wake up, and I didn't, you know, really remember what had happened too clearly, but there was paint all over me, and I never knew. But I never really thought to question. It didn't really matter to me. By my third attempt at the ninth grade, I was blacking out on a fairly regular basis. And, you know, I was one of those alcoholics that I blacked out and went to the store and bought a candy bar. You know, other people would black out and go pick fights or steal cars or do these things. And, you know, I just thought it was normal to forget when you were drinking. And since I wasn't doing anything too particularly crazy, I didn't really see the problem with it. It didn't really scare me that much. People weren't coming back and telling me stories about, oh, you went and bought a Snickers, you know. It was like, whatever, you know. So I still had the delusion everything was normal. This is another thing the book says. It says to the alcoholic, their life seems the only normal one. And I was a teenager, and I was angst at that. So, I mean, there was nothing wrong with what I was doing, and everybody was doing what I was doing, or at least everybody I was hanging out with was. So I was blacking out but not thinking much of it. And by the, you know, the summer there, I started having to, you know, sleep in my car on a regular basis. My friends were getting tired of me, even my friends who drank like me. And I couldn't go home, too drunk to go home and too drunk to go anywhere else. And I was driving drunk on a regular basis. And, you know, I always, of course, we always think that we're fine to drive. And thank God I never got in a wreck with anybody else involved. I remember I had passed out at the wheel, and I was driving over a bridge, and I hit the curb on the bridge and lost a hubcap and didn't think much of it. I was like, oh, you know, I better go park. So I went and parked and, you know, did the same thing again the next night. And I started to think back to my Alateen days where I had learned about this line that the alcoholic crosses, the point of no return. But I was so sure of my intellect, of my self-knowledge, that I thought that I could stop before that happened. You know, I knew I was flirting with danger, but I was sure that I was going to be able to surmount it. I really thought I would know when that line had crossed, and I think that by this point it had been a long time ago. So I started, you know, trying to watch for that line, and then eventually I realized it had come. I was about, I would say 18, almost, no, I was 18th birthday, I got my possessions charge, and they impounded my car. And by that point I had already been trying to quit drinking. I was dating somebody, as I always was, and I at first, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to quit drinking. You guys can do what you want to do, but I'm not going to drink. So I'd go to the parties, and I'd not drink for about 10 minutes and fall back into it. And so then I was like, well, if he would quit, then I could quit. I just need somebody to quit with me. And so I tried to make him quit, and, you know, I think, not pronouncing, but he was a lot like me. He couldn't quit either, and I didn't really care. Because I had this feeling inside of me. Again, the book talks about this, the alcoholic in their default state is restless, irritable, and discontented. And I didn't know what that was. You know, I thought it was normal, hormonal. You know, I blamed the entire outside world for what was wrong with me. And so I thought it was all of these things outside of me that made me feel that way. But I knew that when I drank that went away, that was okay. And so that didn't work. We tried that for a while. That didn't work. So then finally I realized that I couldn't go to the parties. I remembered in Alateen they used to say, you know, you have to change your playgrounds and your playmates. And so that was going to be hard for me because being a person who who felt like they had this void inside of them and felt the only thing that had ever made that go away was this fellowship of druggies and alcohol. It was hard for me to just white knuckle that. So I tried not to go to the parties and I tried not to do those things, but I couldn't do it. It got to a point to where I knew that if somebody, one of my friends, so much as called me and invited me out, that I would not have the power to not go. So, you know, me, the raging feminist, the woman who roars, I knew that the only way to get out of this was to break up with the boyfriend and leave all the friends, which were originally his friends anyway. So I started trying to figure out how that could happen. And, you know, I love to be the victim. I love to not have to look inside myself for what needs to be changed and not have to take the blame for things. So I really wanted it to be his fault. And I felt like if I could get him to do something horrible enough that even he would know that I should never take him back. And then everybody else would know that he was a terrible person and that they would understand why I wouldn't be there and they wouldn't call and they wouldn't ask me to come hang out. So I started picking fights with him. I started, you know, he was a blackout drinker. He came from a violent home. I knew he had violent tendencies. And I started doing everything I could to pick fights with him and try to get him to get violent. And one night I succeeded. I remember the day before, I was sitting on the porch of the house that I had been drinking at for the last 3 years. And I was already supposed to be graduating and had missed the time. And I was still in the ninth grade. There was no way it was going to happen. I felt completely hopeless. And I was at that jumping off point. And I knew that it's going to have to end right now. I'm going to have to get sober right now. And I had no conception of that being like a forever thing. You know, I thought maybe I'd just kind of dry out a bit. Or that it was going to go drastically downhill really fast. And I just had this sense, this, you know, that it's now or never. And I think that night, like, I was drunk, but I had an almost out-of-body experience where I could kind of see myself. And I think, you know, I remember that night I had drank everything I had to drink, and I had stolen everything I could steal to drink or use. And, you know, I was slurring my speech and falling into walls, but my head was stone cold sober. Stone cold sober. You know, none of that stuff was gone. It had quit working. And so this is when I decided to you know, pick the fight with him. So the next night, I knew it was the night. The whole night, I was ready for it. It was going to happen. And it's funny about these things. You know, you plan them out in your head, but you really don't have any control over it once it happens. And, you know, when we started the fight, you know, he got violent. And I remember, you know, just trying to, we were both drunk. And at some point, I lost both my contacts, which I can see, like, literally this far away from my face without my contacts, blind as a bat. And I was trying to gather everything that I owned out of his house so that I never, ever, ever had to go back there again. And it wasn't even about getting away from him. It was about getting away from this addiction. And he knocked me up against the wall at one point and was choking me, and he choked me until I passed out. And I don't know how long I was out. I don't really think it was all that long, but when I came to, he was in the other room flipping channels. And you know, the thing is that I wasn't even scared. I just remember laying there kind of playing possum, and I was like, all right, you know, I had the adrenaline going through my body. I was like, you know, I got to jiggle the handle this way to get out and so, you know, I can get to my car before he can get to me. And I did all that, and, you know, he got to me, knocked me down. And his next-door neighbor was this old Southern Baptist preacher who came out and just stood there and just watched and just said, can I help you? And I felt this big at that moment. I realized that I had become like an after-school movie special, you know? And I thought about who I was as a child. And, you know, I was this feminist. I was this person who valued education and valued themselves and didn't understand women like that. And here I was, and I was that. So, you know, he left and I got my car and I drove away. And I knew that I would never ever do that again. I would never touch that stuff again. And I was happy because I was free. And I drove home drunk with no contacts, virtually from memory. I remember crossing a bridge and saying, okay, I think it turns about here. And I don't remember getting home. I don't know if somebody helped me or what. I woke up the next day. My car was there. And he came over the next day. And this was the final break scene where, you know, I would say, you're a terrible person. And he would feel bad. And then he would leave and everything would be okay. And we did that. And I got away. You know, I did everything that I had planned. And I got away from that. And then 3 hours later, I was back. 3 hours is all it took. And, you know, I drank and I used that last night. And the whole time, again, I mean, it didn't do anything for me. It had quit working. And I just kept, you know, I remember my drug dealer walking past me and nobody would look at my face. And if they did, they had this, like, you know, look of disgust. And I imagine they weren't even disgusted with me. They were probably disgusted with him. But, you know, I just, a whole day of feeling this big. And, you know, I thank God for that today because after that day, I never went back. After that day, I woke up the next day and I called my Alateen sponsor. I was going to get sober in Alateen. Doesn't really work, for those of you who are wondering. But that was my plan. And so I called her. And, you know, I like being this part in Bill's story where he talks about his wife, Lois, and she says that she could tell he really meant business. And, of course, after that, he drank. But I was at that point where, you know, I really meant business. And I called her and I said, I don't know what to do, but I can't keep doing this. And she said, come over. And she sent me to an Alateen meeting that night, and she told me to share, and I shared, and they took me in their arms. And I spent, you know, the next couple of months trying to get sober in Alateen. But the thing was is that they were really a lot of Al-Anons. And I'm not knocking Al-Anons by any means, but they're not alcoholics. They don't have the isms that we do, or maybe they do, but those people there, they didn't understand why I couldn't just go to a few meetings and be okay, and why, you know, I was still kind of crazy sober. They really felt like, you know, I could just stop doing these things and I would be all right. And I felt that they didn't get me. And so after being there for a little while, I decided to go to an AA meeting. So I did, you know, the only logical thing. I found a guy in AA and started dating him. And, you know, I mean, that made perfect sense. And so he started taking me to AA meetings. And I don't remember my first AA meeting. I was so incredibly nervous. I remember I would, you know, they had the, like, the little windows in the doors, and I would stand at the window and kind of look in to wait until they were done saying their name so I didn't have to speak in front of people. And I would go and I would sit down, and when they started to do the Lord's Prayer, I would strategically place my phone and my keys so that I could grab it with one hand and be out of there before anybody would talk to me. And you know, I went to AA, and I really thought that, you know, that would be it. I'd just go to AA meetings. But at about 6 months sober, I was still dating this guy, and I was still, like, completely crazy. I was still not nice to my parents. I had that feeling, that restless irritability and discontentment inside of me. And I started to listen to what people were sharing in these meetings. Now, I had heard them talk about the steps, but I got sober young, so I wasn't sick enough that I needed that. It didn't apply to me. And when I finally hit this bottom sober, this was my first bottom in sobriety, emotional bottom, I realized that I was working the first step. You know, the first step in AA says that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. Well, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew that day that I called my Alateen sponsor, but I had no idea that my life was unmanageable. I still had this feeling that if I just don't drink, then I can manage my life just fine, and I don't need any of this other stuff. But I didn't know what was wrong with me, and I started listening to these people in AA meetings, and, you know, I didn't think that. I got sober in Macon. They didn't have young people's AA meetings. There's, like, two other young people sober at the time. And these people who are, like, you know, 20, 30 years older than me, and, you know, from all these different kind of backgrounds, I didn't think that they could understand me. But when I started actually listening to what they had to say, they may have been talking about husbands or wives, and I had boyfriends, but, you know, they were saying the same thing. They were describing the same stuff. And so I decided to get a sponsor and work the steps. And I still wasn't sure about this whole AA thing. You know, I thought maybe that AA was a cult. It was a little freaky how you all chanted and held hands and prayed. So I picked this lady to be my sponsor, and I went to her house. And I rang the doorbell, and she said, come in, and I wouldn't because I wanted her to get up so that I could have first pick of the seats so I could get the one closest to the door so that if she brought out the incense and robes, I could jet. And And so, you know, and I sat down, and gosh, to my surprise, she just started talking with me. And she just talked with me about her life, and I talked with her about my life, and we found out that we had a lot in common, and there was nothing shoved down my throat. It was kind of take it or leave it, but this is what worked for me. And I tried leaving it, and this is what happened to me. So we started on the process of working the steps. You know, the first step, like I said, she kind of explained to me her experience, and that was it. You know, that was what I had worked the first step. You know, the second step, we talked about, and we went through the book and all that. But I think that for me, like, I came to believe through talking with her that day that, you know, she was enough like me, and she had found something that worked for her. Maybe it could work for me too. And then the third step was, you know, when I made a decision to work the rest of the steps. It was that simple. And, you know, I a friend of mine talks about this, like the feeling of, for a need of her certificate of, for completion for the third step, you know, like there's supposed to be angels or light or something, you know, like I felt like I was really supposed to have this connection with God at that point. You know, but I didn't, because I had all this stuff I hadn't looked at yet in the fourth and fifth step still blocking me from my higher power. And so, you know, when I continued working the steps with her, we went through my fifth step, and I started looking at all of these things in me, and I started realizing that my entire life, even in Idaho, I had this void in me, in this sense that these things outside of me could complete me, that they could make me better. And, you know, I love what, there's this part in the 12th step, in the fourth step, in the 12 and 12, where it talks about how, you know, alcoholics, we have this over-dependence on our instincts. You know, the same way that normal people, they drink one or two drinks, and that's it. With me, like, I was looking for the answer in alcohol. I was expecting more than what was naturally intended out of my drinking experience. I did that with everything. I did that with relationships, and I did that with, you know, social instinct, and, you know, wanting to be the best at things, and that none of those things ever worked out for me, you know? Like, I always thought if I could get this person or these people to love me enough or in the right way, I'd be okay. And even if they did, I always found out that it still wasn't enough. And I realized, you know, long story short, that wasn't the answer. That wasn't going to work. And, you know, I continued working the rest of the steps with her, and by the time I got to the ninth step, I was still a little wary about whether or not this was true, but she had told me that she had found an answer through loving other people, essentially. That it wasn't about getting from the world, it was about giving to it. That all of the times where I thought I had needed respect or needed love, I had needed to give love and give respect. And of course, that doesn't mean being a doormat. There is a line there, but for me, with that connection with a higher power, that's where I could find out where that line was. And, you know, I started working the steps on that relationship. And it was amazing for me because, you know, I had, of course, when I was planning this talk, you know, I planned to say a lot of stuff I didn't say. But I had always been that really insanely jealous girlfriend, you know, the one who was just kind of crazy. And I had always just depended so much on whoever it was I was dating to have the answers for everything. And I was just demanding and needy. And after working the steps on that relationship and, you know, in the rest of my life, I became a person who I didn't wake up and, you know, yell at my mother for not being, you know, June Cleaver. That's an old TV show for you young folks. June Cleaver, yeah. I woke up and looked for what I could do to help her. You know, I did the dishes without asking, and then I didn't even tell her I did them. And I started trying to mend these old relationships, and my whole attitude changed towards my relationship with people in my family. You know, it became about how can I be a good daughter, not how do you suck as a parent. And through this process, you know, I discovered something really amazing. I have wonderful parents. They didn't suck. They never sucked. You know, it was never them. And I did the same thing in this relationship with this guy. You know, I became the person who he felt like he could talk to. And, you know, he eventually relapsed, and I went through a hard time with that. But it was amazing for me to be able to work the steps and be strong in the program and have a sponsor and a network of people I could talk to. And as, you know, he was going out and I was staying strong, I started looking at our relationship as an opportunity for me to be a walking big book to him. You know, not to be a sponsor, but to be an example. And, you know, and that was amazing for me. And, you know, it's kind of amazing because he's sober again now. I ran into him in Macon not too long ago. And I feel like I'm in a position now where, you know, I can look him in the eye and he doesn't have to feel like he can't come to an AA meeting because that crazy girl's there, you know. And that means a lot to me today. So, you know, I got to a point where I was doing all of these things and it was amazing. There were resentments that I had to all these people, and they used to say it's amazing how when we start to get better, they start to get better too, you know, the Al-Anons. And it's true. It really was true for me. I have a relationship with my mother today where, you know, I confide in her about things and she confides in me, and I became the good daughter, the one who they trust and the one who they're proud of. And, you know, and that's absolutely incredible. So, you know, there's this this other speaker I like who talks about, you know, there's that invisible line I already mentioned where you cross the line from being a problem drinker to an alcoholic. But I think that there's an invisible line that a lot of people don't know about or don't talk about. Well, I think a lot of people know about it, but I haven't heard it talked about a whole lot in this terminology, where you cross the line from being, you know, a sick and suffering alcoholic or drug addict to being a recovering or recovered, you know, drug addict or alcoholic. And I think that crossing that line is where you cross the line from being a taker to being a giver, you know. And so for me, that's it today. You know, I am now, you know, working the 12 step. Oh, I forgot to tell you guys, I got sober October 1st of 1999, and celebrated the millennium sober. That was fun. And actually, it wasn't. It sucked, but really bad. But you know, but that's it for me today. I know that that's my solution. And you know, people shy away from this stuff about God, and I can understand that. I can understand why a lot of people are really iffy with the whole religion thing. You know, but for me, it's amazing. I think that, you know, my friend Scott always referenced this part in the book where it talks about how God is everything or God is nothing. And what I realize for me is that if I'm not in God's will, and if I'm not, you know, trying to do the best I can to carry this message, that I'm just going to ruin everything I have in my life anyway, drunk or sober. And chances of me staying sober are slim to none. So, you know, I hit that point where I had that desperation. I love when people talk about that because you can see it in a newcomer's eyes, the ones who come in and, you know, they're just like, whatever, you know, and they're too good for this thing. That was me. But for whatever reason, I was lucky enough to stay around until I hit that hopelessness, you know, that point of complete defeat. And I was willing to do anything you said to do, to not have to feel this way anymore, you know. And so, you know, I don't know. Today, life is phenomenal. I have found a new fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous that is 10 times better than the one with the druggies. And, you know, the thing about it is that those druggies, you know, they eventually started stealing from you, and I eventually started stealing from them, and you know, we started hitting on each other's boyfriends or whatever, and those bonds were broken. And I run into those people today, and I don't shy away from them, but it's, you know, there's a disconnection there. And here in AA, in, you know, the past few years, I have realized that there are people who I knew when I got sober in Macon who I have not seen for years. And occasionally I'll go down to some service thing or something and run into them, and when I see them, it's just like, you know, my heart skips a beat. I'm so happy, and we strike it off right where we left it. You know, it's like I haven't missed a thing, and it's been amazing to develop these relationships with people that I'm 100% confident that if I maintain this thing, will never ever go away. So I pray to God that I never forget what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. I pray to God that I never forget that I need this fellowship. I need all of it. I'm a sickie. I need the meetings. I need the steps. I need a sponsor. I need sponsees, you know, and I need to practice this in every single thing that I do. My relationships, you know, my work, all of it. I need to practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all of it, you know, and if I do, then God willing, I will be around for a long time. So thank you so much for listening tonight.
Thank you so much, Katie, for sharing with us today. That was very, I don't have a word. It was awesome. Thank you.